Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgain. They say politics makes for strange bedfellows. Now that the Supreme Court has given its blessing to escalating the price of free speech, politicians are increasingly seeking wealthy partners to fund campaigns, and such partnerships are garnering criticism from opposition groups.
Let the public know you've got this out-of-state billionaire who wants to tell you how to vote because he thinks that's good for you.
Washington Governor Jay Inslee recently met with California hedge fund founder and billionaire Tom Steyer. Steyer has pledged this year to raise and spend $100 million to elect climate-friendly governors and members of Congress. Correspondent Austin Jenkins reports on the climate policy and money connection. That story coming up in about 7 minutes. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge. I'm Kathleen Morgain. Northwest farmers can expect longer growing seasons, drier summers, and increased risk of disease and pest outbreaks. Those are some of the predictions in the National Climate Assessment that came out this week. From Seattle, Ann Dornfeld has this look at how the changing climate might affect our gardens.
Most of the research about the impact of climate change on Northwest agriculture focuses on what might happen east of the Cascades, to major crops like wheat, wine grapes, and irrigated potatoes. But most of us are farming on a much smaller scale, like John Mullen, who's turning over the soil in his plot at this Capitol Hill pea patch.
There's an old root.
Mullen has been gardening in the Northwest for more than 3 decades. He says he's noticed higher high temperatures and lower lows.
So the summers are definitely seeing longer periods where we're hitting the 90s, which really helps tomatoes grow, because that's a notoriously difficult crop here. And it's also good for roses.
Mullen says one downside is the winter cold spells, like a recent one that cost him his artichoke plant. Overall, though, Washington State University agricultural researcher Chad Kruger says Seattle-area gardeners won't be seeing major changes anytime soon. He was one of the authors of the Northwest portion of the National Climate Assessment.
I think for the intermediate future, the likelihood that gardeners in Seattle experience substantial changes that would be recognizable as attributable to climate are probably pretty lean.
Kruger says the biggest changes are likely toward the end of this century, like significantly longer growing seasons. Still, Kruger says one short-term challenge could be drought as summers get drier.
How much water is available? At what cost is it available? Are there prohibitions on the use of water in yards and gardens? That could actually be a fairly serious impact that people will experience.
So the next time you're at the garden store, maybe walk right past that Meyer lemon tree and head for the succulents. I'm Ann Dornfeld.
Political discussions about climate change usually align along the expected party lines. With increasing dissension in the political process, there's a lot of debate these days about unlimited money in politics and whether it corrupts the process. But does it matter who's giving the money and what their motivation is? In Washington State, Governor Jay Inslee has found a wealthy partner in his fight to combat global climate change. He is California hedge fund founder Tom Steyer, a man the L.A. Times says may be the liberals' answer to the conservative billionaire Koch brothers. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins reports on Inslee's connection to this out-of-state billionaire.
For some Democrats, Tom Steyer is like a real-life Bruce Wayne, a.k.a. Batman.
Bruce, this is Harvey Dent.
Rachel's told me everything about you.
I certainly hope not.
He's a billionaire businessman turned philanthropist who wants to save not just Gotham City, but the entire planet from global climate change. Here's Steyer speaking with NPR's David Green earlier this year.
I think the way we define our mission is to act politically to prevent climate disaster and preserve American prosperity.
Now, if Steyer is Batman in this Democratic narrative, then think of Governor Jay Inslee as Police Commissioner James Gordon.
I know exactly who he was. It was the Batman.
Batman and the police commissioner are united in their desire to rid Gotham City of crime, and they have a back-channel working relationship. Similarly, Steyer and Governor Inslee share a passion for combating global climate change. And in the last year, they've developed a working relationship that's not well known to outsiders. According to public records and interviews, the two men first met last May at a climate change fundraiser in Seattle. Steyer was the keynote speaker and used the opportunity to declare a West Coast climate strategy.
We're going to have the most comprehensive energy and climate policies in the world. We're going to join together to cooperate in a program to control CO2 emissions.
Afterwards, Steyer and Inslee met privately for about 30 minutes. Governor Inslee recently recalled that meeting.
We had a good chat, and I was just really impressed with his obvious, you know, really deep personal interest in defeating this problem.
Inslee says at that meeting last May, he and Steyer discussed a special state Senate election between incumbent Democrat Nathan Schlicker and Republican challenger Jan Angel. That election was key in the Democrats' effort to retake control of the Washington Senate.
I do recall talking to him about that particular race. We had a great candidate. I really liked the candidate and told him what I knew about the candidate. So he said he was interested in being involved.
Over the next few months, Steyer pumped more than $500,000 into Washington State. One of the key beneficiaries of his money was a PAC called She's Changed. It ran negative ads against Republican Jan Angel.
After 13 years in politics, Representative Angel just isn't who I thought she was.
Republicans quickly took note of the fact a liberal billionaire from California was playing in Washington's political sandbox. Randy Pepl is a Republican operative who dug into Steyer's spending last fall.
Let the public know you've got this out-of-state billionaire who wants to tell you how to vote because he thinks that's good for you.
Pepl serves up the same sort of indignation you hear from liberals who are incensed about the Koch brothers. They're the billionaire industrialists who work to elect conservative candidates. As far as Pepl is concerned, Tom Steyer deserves the same sort of scrutiny. But it's a tougher sell.
Do you agree that you have a harder job trying to get people concerned about Tom Steyer when he says he's trying to combat global climate change as opposed to somebody who's just trying to protect their own business interests?
Well, it's harder just because in this state, it's accepted that someone like Steyer's wearing a white hat.
Steyer's critics question whether he's totally altruistic and point to his previous investments in fossil fuels. Of course, Washington Democrats were delighted when Steyer decided to put his money into defeating Republican Jan Angel.
We knew it was going to be an uphill battle.
Democratic operative Dana Laurent.
We knew it was going to take everything that we had.
Laurent says she helped Tom Steyer's PAC target its spending in Washington State. I asked her how important Steyer's money was last year.
It was very significant. It was a very significant development and a much appreciated one.
In the end, though, it didn't stop Republican Angel from winning that key seat in the Washington Senate. Records show Inslee called Steyer about a month after the election. Inslee says they discussed the defeat. And Inslee makes no apologies about talking or working with Steyer.
If you had 100 Mr. Steyer's, it wouldn't make up for the dollars on the other side of this controversy. So I don't think we should have any worry about overwhelming the public with information that doesn't get a fair shake in this. I'm confident the oil and gas industry and the coal industry is going to be able to get their story told here. So
this year, Steyer has reportedly pledged to raise and spend $100 million to elect climate-friendly governors and members of Congress. What we don't know yet is if Steyer's 2014 crusade will include Washington State. In January, Steyer's staff met with Inslee's staff to discuss the 2014 landscape. Through a spokeswoman, Steyer turned down an interview request for this story. His staff told me they may have more to say about a Washington State strategy for 2014 in the coming weeks. I'm Austin Jenkins reporting.
Big infusions of out-of-area cash are the exception rather than the rule in rural Northwest elections. In rural counties, the personal touch goes a long way toward name recognition. Making an impression on voters one at a time could make a big difference in the contest for Oregon's West Lane County Commissioner this month. Conservative Commissioner Jay Bozovich is being challenged by moderate candidate Don Leslie. Both are relying on the ground game to reach voters. Rachel McDonald reports on their door-to-door campaign.
Hello. Hello. I'm Jay Bozovich. I'm your county commissioner, and I'm running for re-election. I'm coming around and asking people for their support for May 20th.
Hi. Are you Nancy?
Yes.
I'm Dawn Leslie, and this is my son Clayton, and I'm running for county commissioner. So I'm just talking to voters.
Both candidates were knocking on doors this past weekend, bringing their message directly to voters in the West Lane District, which spans from West Eugene north to Junction City and west to Florence. Lane Community College political science instructor Steve Candy calls this retail politics.
With these local races, you know, I think it's absolutely essential. And oftentimes races are decided by, you know, what they refer to sometimes as the ground game. Boots on the ground, getting all of your supporters out there working for you, talking to people.
On a recent weekend in Vinita, many people didn't answer when Dawn Leslie knocked on their door.
Quite frankly, I've never heard of you.
Okay.
Isn't that awful?
No.
Leslie, an engineer who's running for office for the first time, says it's worth it to be out in the district she hopes to represent.
The people who want to know me will say, no one's ever come to my door before, or, you know, I've never met one of my elected officials. I've never met a county commissioner. So if you get elected, I will know one of the, you know, I will have met one of the county commissioners, and they like that. And an exchange happens that I think is the way it's supposed to be. We're supposed to be open and accessible to the public, and we're supposed to be listening to their views.
Leslie says she got into the race because she didn't like what she saw happening on the board.
I'm concerned that we're not moving forward on recovering from the recession and creating the new economy for the future where Lane County is thriving again and where we have a functioning public safety system. And I'm watching our commissioners have scandals and backroom deals and lawsuits, cover-ups.
The board's most recent scandal involved the firing of County Administrator Leanne Richardson. She had been illegally converting leave time to take-home pay. In a heavily redacted report, Richardson told an investigator that three board members, including Jay Bozovich, were aware of what she was doing. Bozovich says Richardson was dishonest about her pay, so her claims that commissioners were aware of it are also lies.
Unfortunately, it makes a great headline for the Register Guard to say Richardson said commissioners knew, and then you had to read down through their entire article to the end to say, and by the way, the investigator found her to be untruthful.
Many people criticize Bozovich and the other conservative board members for the redistricting of the county after the 2010 election. Most of the more progressive voters in Lane County are now concentrated in the South Eugene District. Janice Marshall joined Dawn Leslie going door-to-door in Vinita. She says she doesn't live in the West Lane District, but...
In a way, I'm representing the many people that got redistricted out of this district that share my beliefs that because of Jay, he made sure that their votes don't count as much.
Political science instructor Steve Candy says Bozovich may be more vulnerable than fellow conservative board members Sid Lykin and Faye Stewart, who are also up for re-election.
I think Jay is perceived differently than the other, you know, conservatives, the other Republicans, because I think people see him as more actively engaged rather than sort of going along with stuff.
Bozovich's supporters say he's got principles and isn't afraid to stand up for them.
Jay has to be reelected. There's no ifs, ands, or buts.
Margaret Thummel is a Eugene businesswoman. She joined Bozovich on a recent day of canvassing in the Bethel neighborhood.
We have so many problems. And we really need common sense people running these jurisdictions.
Bozovich says he's running for re-election because he wants to continue to work on bringing more jobs to the county and improving public safety.
Those are the two big issues I ran on 4 years ago. I spent the last almost 3.5 years now doing just those things. And what I want to do is continue. Those are going to be my priorities, is job creation and public safety.
Bozovich was instrumental in helping to bring a call center to Vinita and worked with State Representative Val Hoyle on the new state hospital in Junction City. During his term on the board, the county successfully got a public safety levy approved by voters. Jobs and public safety top the list of priorities for both candidates for the West Lane board seat. The deadline to vote in the primary election is May 20th. I'm Rachel McDonald in Eugene.
Still coming up, from politics to culture, we continue our series on the millennials with a profile of a young man whose beliefs mirror the religious trend in this generation. He no longer believes in God.
To be not religious and to deal with life on your own terms enables you to be a leader in your own life.
We'll hear about navigating life without faith coming up right after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Today, rainy and breezy with south winds 5 to 15 miles per hour, gusting to 30 miles per hour, then increasing to 15 to 25 miles per hour with gusts to 40 miles per hour this afternoon. The chance of rain today near 100% with rainfall amounts around a half of an inch. High temperatures 55 to 60. Then tonight, showers in the forecast with southwest winds 10 to 20 miles per hour, overnight lows 45 to 50. When it comes to religion, young adults feel a lot differently about the subject than previous generations. People in their 20s are less likely to be affiliated with organized religion. They're also more likely to say they don't believe in God. So what is it like to be a young person navigating life without faith? Reporter Florangela Davila introduces us to a 20-something digital marketing manager.
His name is James Brown. Really, it's a family name. He's curly-haired, skinny, and 6 feet tall. He drives a very yellow Ford Mustang. He shows me how his car pretty much holds a lot of what matters in his life, including...
Here's my rock climbing harness.
And two swords to practice fencing.
Advance. Extend. Advance lunge.
Brown tells me later why he enjoys fencing and his other hobby, rock climbing. They keep him grounded.
It helps me situate myself and my place in the universe and what I'm able to accomplish.
So on a Sunday when everyone's going to church, what are you usually doing?
Footwork classes at the fencing club.
And is it your church?
I would call it my community.
As a boy, Brown's community was his church. He grew up reading Bible stories with his dad. He used to pray before meals. He says religion...
I feel like it was a very big part of my life.
As a teen, he spent many summers at Bible camp.
We rode trail bikes, we rode horses, we played paintball.
He'd go to camp every year with the same group of friends. But the last year he was there, things changed. He was 17. That year, like years past, a live band played Christian rock music for the kids.
At the end of the set, the singer was saying to everybody, if you haven't accepted Jesus into your heart, do that with me now.
Brown closed his eyes.
And I didn't feel anything. I didn't feel anybody there that was talking to me. I didn't feel any presence there. And so that was the break for me. It wasn't a journey so much as it was a hard stop.
Brown's experience reflects a growing trend among millennials, especially among men. According to the Pew Research Center, 39% of young adults aren't certain God exists, or they simply don't believe. For Brown, it wasn't just a simple change of heart. It hit him square in the gut.
It was an acceptance of what's really out there or not out there and the way that the world works. And that was very, very lonely for me.
Brown says this just happened. It wasn't a conscious choice, and even if it had been, it wouldn't have been an easy one.
I struggled for many years to reconcile the fact that I was going to die someday and there would be nothing after. And I still haven't resolved that. You just make every day count and you do the best that you can.
He says doing his best means figuring out his own beliefs without religion as a guide. But he says that this is a good thing. It's forced him to come up with decisions on all sorts of things, including controversial ones like abortion. But he welcomes that.
To be not religious and to deal with life on your own terms enables you to be a leader in your own life.
He actually thinks if more people shared his view on God and religion, it could be a good thing.
If the nation as a whole becomes less religious, I feel like we'll be able to debate ideological issues without such vitriol and maybe make headway and progress and evolve.
Brown has evolved himself. It's been 10 years since he quit God. He no longer calls himself an atheist. He's an agnostic. And when I ask him about his future and having kids himself, he tells me something surprising.
I won't tell you that I would not raise them with some type of religion because I might. It was a great experience for me when I was younger.
He says he wants his children to know about religion and be exposed to many different kinds. He just doesn't want to force it on them. I'm Flor Angela Davila reporting.
Overall, 20-somethings often get a bad rap. You've heard the stereotypes: heads buried in smartphones, sleeping in their parents' basement, too apathetic to care about anything, especially getting involved in politics. In the last of our Generation M reports, we meet a Northwest 20-something who's working hard to overcome his generation's reputation. He's doing something that many millennials do, effecting political change in his own unique way. Salem correspondent Chris Lehman has this profile.
I first met Brian Williamson at the Oregon State Capitol. He was advocating for his favorite cause the old-fashioned way, sitting in front of lawmakers.
My name is Brian Williamson. I'm a student at Oregon State University.
Williamson was there to ask for money, millions of dollars, to upgrade wheelchair ramps, install elevators, and take care of the other barriers to access on public university campuses around Oregon. He had about 4 minutes to make his case. His audience, some of the most powerful lawmakers in the building.
On most of our campuses, accessibility means much more than
this. This was Williamson's first time in front of a legislative panel. They turned him down. So he decided to take another route and try something that a lot of millennials do: tackle the issue hands-on. In this case, his hands are on a wheelchair that I'm sitting in.
First thing, don't lean back in this chair.
Okay.
Don't lean back. We don't have any.
I'm on the campus of Oregon State University in Corvallis. I don't normally use a wheelchair, but that's the point of this demonstration. It's to put me in the seat of disabled OSU students who have to navigate the sprawling campus. Williamson leads tours every Friday. He points me in the direction of the library. It's up a bit of an incline.
You're going to look at this and go, well, this is going to be rather difficult.
Yes, I agree with that.
We have board of trustees members out here. We get faculty members out here, students. And they go, oh, my gosh, I can't believe that there's people that do this every single day.
Hills aren't the only thing in the way of someone in a wheelchair at OSU. Williams takes me to buildings without elevators, doors that won't open wide enough for me to squeeze through, and ramps like this one that are too steep.
All right, now be careful as you go down this. I'll get behind you and make sure that you don't get too far out of control.
A consulting firm hired by Oregon State found that despite the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act, there are literally thousands of accessibility issues on the campus of Oregon State alone. And Williamson points out that I'm getting the chance to negotiate them on a sunny spring day.
Think about doing this in either the rain or in snow or ice, in anything but optimal conditions. You can imagine this to be rather difficult.
Williamson is 20 years old. Clean cut, slender. He isn't raising awareness of disability issues for his own sake. The poli-sci major gets around just fine. He says he's had a passion for helping those less fortunate ever since he saw his younger sister get bullied.
She had a really bad speech impediment as a little child. Because of that, there's a lot of bullying and things like that that she had to go through, and a lot of kids picked on her at school and in the neighborhood and all that.
He says that opened his eyes to the everyday struggles faced by people with physical disabilities. And when he arrived at Oregon State, he jumped right in and tried to help. Oh, and another thing he did when he got to college? He became a frat brother.
Yeah, I totally understand that, you know, that whole Animal House stereotype or stigma around Greek life and everything about that. But, you know, I didn't join my fraternity for, you know, the party scene and whatnot.
Williamson's fraternity, Pi Kappa Phi, isn't really known for its toga parties. On the contrary, it's through his fraternity that Williamson is planning a cross-country bike ride this summer to raise funds for disability causes.
The stereotype, I think, can be beat.
And when Oregon lawmakers return to the Capitol next winter, Williamson plans to be back in front of them.
We plan on, you know, hitting the gas and full throttle all the way through.
Williamson says he isn't going to let his age be a barrier to fighting for his favorite cause, even if many of the lawmakers he's speaking to are old enough to be his grandparents. I'm Chris Lehman in Corvallis, Oregon.
And that is all for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1. That's NEWS, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. I'm Kathleen Morgane, saying thank you for listening today, and listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.